This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Yes, this is the MagicWordPodcast.com, although the music may have confused you a little bit because we're trying something a little bit different. This is not going to be just for this week, but I am going to incorporate using this new theme song for the duration, however long that's going to be into the future. We've been using some other music for quite some time, but I thought I'd kind of get out of my comfort zone and try something a little bit different. And I always encourage you guys to do the same thing, too, that you shouldn't fall into the same habit all the time. You should try and look for something that's going to be new and how that you can improve yourself. And hopefully this might improve the Magic Word Podcast and your listening pleasure a little bit as well by having a little bit different music. Anyhow, this week we're going to be having someone who is from Magic's past. I should say, actually, his grandfather is, and he's going to be talking a lot about that. We're going to welcome Bob Shulian, who is one of the magicians who performs at the Chicago Magic Lounge each week, and he comes from the long line and the family of the Shulians, who had Shulian's Bar, or I guess it was Shulian's Restaurant, actually, in Chicago, which was one of the famous magic bars that thrived throughout the 20th century. It actually was first founded in late 1800s, and then through a succession of owners, all within the Shulian family, and also moving from one location to another, that it continued to thrive and got to be known as a place for people to congregate, not only to eat and have a drink, but also to enjoy magic. And that was where the Chicago style magic actually was formed by Matt Shulian. And that is kind of a fast and furious, or just a, as Bob Shulian would say, fast and quick. Sounds kind of redundant. Anyhow, it's kind of a fast type of magic, because this is something they want to do to try to quickly get to the effect, so this way they can sell more stuff and more drinks, more food, and whatever else, and also get from one table to the next as they sat down and entertained people, as opposed to walking around doing all the strolling, or perhaps standing behind the bar, and they were quick to go and serve other people because they didn't have a lot of time just to stand and sit and chit-chat with everybody because there were a lot of other customers, so you got to keep moving. And so that became known as the Chicago-style magic. And so in this episode, that Bob talks a lot about that style and about his grandfather and the formation of Shulian's and how it became so well recognized, not only in Chicago, but in the surrounding area, but people came from all around, I mean, from states all around, just to enjoy the different kinds of pranks and things that his grandfather, Matt Shulian, would pull on so many people, including Blackstone Sr. There's a great story in here about him as well. There are a lot of really interesting stories, and it just goes on, and I just kind of sat back and listened for a while until Bob kind of wound down a little bit, then I'd ask him another question. I find myself apologizing again for the sound in this episode. The quality is not quite as good as what I would prefer, because we were actually speaking through my computer to his cell phone, and so his side of the conversation is not quite as crisp, plus it sounds like he might have been outside, so you hear some car noise and everything in the background, but it's not too distracting, and I think that you'll be able to certainly understand everything that he's saying. Many of the tricks that Bob talks about that his grandfather, Matt Shulian, had performed are in the book called The Magic of Matt Shulian, which was written by Phil Wilmarth. It's a wonderful book, and if you can get a copy of it, I would highly recommend it. It's a should be required reading for introductory students, because it really tells you how to really do some really commercial magic. I mean, this has got some really good stuff in it that we all do today that we consider classics. And of course, it was originally formed by the legendary Matt Shulian. So you're going to enjoy a lot of the stories that he has today in the podcast. So I have got a few other extra surprises towards the end of the podcast, so after this is over, please listen to the rest. I think you're going to enjoy what we have to talk about. But for now, I'm going to step aside and introduce you then all the way from Chicago. Please welcome Bob Shulian to The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and today I've got with me all the way from Chicago via cell phone over here, Mr. Robert Bob Shulian. Hi there, Bob.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm fantastic, and it's good to hear your voice. And we had met and talked briefly when I was at the Magic Lounge up in Chicago just a few months ago. And that is just a fantastic facility and club that now I guess you've been involved with this since the beginning for the last couple of years with the Chicago Magic Lounge?
Well, I got involved about 6 months after it opened. Bill Weimer, he kind of told me about it, and I decided to check it out for myself, and I've been with him ever since.
But you've been doing magic for a long time, and just kind of as a bit of history, the reason that I really wanted to have you on here, of course, was not only because that you are doing magic and performing over there, but also that you are the son of the famed owner of Shulian's restaurant there in Chicago, which was one of the original bar magic places.
I'm Matt's grandson.
Grandson.
One of 22 grandchildren.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
That's a big family reunion when you guys all get together.
Right. Yeah, it is. My great-grandfather, Joseph Shulian, started the business back in 1881. He was a Schlitz barrel driver.
Mm-hmm.
He drove a wagon, and how he got into the business was, back in those days, breweries liked to own bars because if their beer was selling real well, they didn't want to give it up to a rival.
Uh-huh.
So my great-grandfather, who had a very heavy German accent, he was down on Randolph and LaSalle Street downtown.
Mm-hmm.
A little tavern called, it was a little tavern, and they were selling the Schlitz beer, doing very well. He caught wind, he heard that they were going to be selling, that a rival brewery was going to be buying the tavern. From what I've been told, it was the Berghoff Brewery.
Oh,
what
okay.
I've been told.
Uh-huh.
So he caught wind of it, and he beat them to the punch, and he basically, out of all of his receipts, out of his leather pouch, he purchased it in the name of Schlitz. So the next day, an executive came down from Milwaukee on the train, talked to my great-grandfather, and said, if you think this is that important, we want you to run it. And that's how we got into the bar business.
You said he had a thick German accent, so I assume he was from
Germany,
first
Germany.
Generation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first generation, believe so. First generation from Germany.
Yeah. And when he opened the bar, did he open it under the name of Shulian's?
He called it the Quincy Number 9.
Quincy, okay. Why is that?
They always liked the name Quincy Street.
Hmm.
So he called it the Quincy Number 9. So,
okay.
And it was kind of an interesting name, but anyways, that they ran it from 1881 to about early 1900s, and then they sold it. Then they moved to to Indiana for a few years to down the farm. They own about 100 acres down there, and by late 1919, he purchased the tavern over on Halstead and Willow, and that was the 1800 Club. It was Matt Shulian's. Well, it was eventually going to be Matt Shulian's, but they opened up there in 1919. My grandfather just came back from the war. He was a cook in the American Army, U.S. Mm-hmm. Army, and he got involved. He was 28, 29 years old. So now a year later, the Prohibition set in, and through that period of time, they made that tub gin upstairs in the apartment.
Yeah.
And so they had a very interesting past of Prohibition.
Well, I think that would be. So was it a speakeasy for a while?
It was a speakeasy from 1920 to 1932 when it was repealed.
Wow.
Every bar was a speakeasy. Yeah, the front of the building had grocery store written on it.
Okay.
But the side door was always open, and my grandfather always paid off every commander, every lieutenant, every cop of the district.
I was going to ask you about that. You know, that's something you hear about or see in movies of everything about mobsters and, you know, Chicago gangsters and speakeasies and that kind of a thing. Surely there must have been some fantastic stories that he's passed down to you where that the cops have come in and made some sort of a raid and he had everybody say, no, we're here drinking milkshakes or something.
Yeah. Well, my grandfather, he was locked up for violating the Volstead Act. He got arrested. He got thrown in jail for about 3 days.
Uh-huh.
And from my father, Charlie told me that it was just one big relaxation for 3 days. He sat in the cell and played cards with all his bar buddies.
Yeah.
Now, I guess when they were making bathtub gin upstairs, they would take it and they would pour it into barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what he did is he took red paint and he put a red S on each barrel.
Uh-huh.
He heard stories about alcohol being confiscated. And he caught wind of a lot of liquor was being shipped down to New Orleans.
Okay.
So he put a red S on each barrel. I mean, as soon as he got out of jail, he got one of the porters and dishwashers to go with him. He got down to the shipyard somewhere downtown Chicago. He broke in there. And he sold he got his barrels back, two or three barrels of bathtub gin.
Because he knew which ones were his and left the rest of them.
Yeah, left the rest of them. And my dad, Charlie, told me that Al Capone came in there once into Halsted Street.
Uh-huh.
He walked up to the bar and said, "Matt, how are you?" "Good, Al, how are you?" Of course, my grandpa didn't say much in front of Al Capone.
Wow.
He says, "How's the beer flowing?" "Beer's flowing fine." "Put a $100 bill in the bar. Just give everybody a drink." And he said, "Keep the change." Now,
wow.
What are drinks? 50 cents, a dollar? I mean, a dollar is a lot of money in those days.
Well, probably more like about a nickel or a quarter.
Yeah, right. And it must have been a very interesting time.
Wow.
So my grandfather ran a speakeasy through the 20s, and through that time, you know, he met a lot of vaudeville actors and actresses that came in their place, and he met a gentleman by the name of Harry Blackstone Jr., or Sr.
Yeah.
He was a magician, and they were doing some card tricks at the bar, and my grandfather really kind of got interested in it. He looked at it, and he said, "This is pretty good." So I started fooling around with some cards and invented a couple of the Shulian tricks, the color change and the matchbook. And as he's dabbling in it, his father, Joseph Shulian, "Mac, you put down the cards and you get to work. Go 10 bar." "Okay, Pa." So months of frequency now. All of a sudden, this magic's getting good. People are saying, "Hey, Matt, show us some magic." And finally, a light bulb went off in my great-grandfather's head. "Matt, why don't you do some magic and I'll 10 bar?" And that's how it all started.
Wow.
So my grandfather became very well known. He became very good friends with Harry Blackstone Sr.
Uh-huh.
So now, my grandfather, he liked to pull pranks on people. There were two pranks that became world-renowned of its day. One was the goldfish-eating trick. I believe my grandfather invented the goldfish-eating. He started it.
Okay, I can explain that.
What he would do is he would have a fish bowl behind the bar with two fish swimming around, goldfish, and he would put the bowl on top of the bar, and he'd tell people, "What do you see in the bowl?" "Oh, look at that. It's two little goldfish." Well, in the afternoons, he would sit down while he's playing cards, pull out a little knife, and he would whittle carrots into life-size goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
And he would put them in his vest pocket. So my grandfather was a very heavy man. So he was able to hide everything on because of his rolls of fat.
Yeah.
But his vest was so big. So anyways, his pockets were stuffed with carrots. So in comes this friend from Chicago, and he says, "Hey, man, we got a good. I have a good friend of mine, Joe. He came in from Michigan. Hey, would you give him a goldfish?" "Sure, give me time." So I get up at the bar, they get the drinks, and my grandfather brings the bowl over. "Hey, what do you see in the bowl?" "Also, I see goldfish." He goes, "Yeah, okay." So what he does, he takes out a carrot, puts it in his hand, puts it in the water, and wiggles the carrot out. Looks like he's chasing a goldfish. He says, "Open your mouth." "What?" "Open your mouth." Guy opens his mouth, he throws a goldfish, he throws a carrot in the guy's mouth.
Yeah.
"Oh, it's a carrot. Ha, ha, ha." Then there's always some wise guy sitting next to him.
Uh-huh.
"Hey, do that to me." He says, "All right, open your mouth." He throws a goldfish in the guy's mouth.
The real goldfish.
A real goldfish. That became world renowned. And people from all over loved it. All over the world.
Wow.
His second prank was, my grandfather burned down cities. What he did was he did a fake fire broadcast on the radio. Back in those days, they didn't have cassette tapes yet for music systems, so they would take a microphone, turn it on, and put it toward the radio, and that would be the pipe to music for the restaurant. So my grandfather was very big with conventions. They were always jammed with conventions. So, for example, there was a lumber convention going on in town, and his friends were in, and they brought friends from Akron, Ohio, Joe and Mary Smith. Hey, man, let's meet Joe and Mary Smith. How are you? Nice to meet you. And my grandpa always had a cigar in the side of his mouth.
Uh-huh.
And so my friend said, man, burn him. Okay, give me time. So the evening progresses. My grandfather goes to the office, turns off the radio, grabs the microphone and says, we're bringing you this special bulletin straight from ABC News or NBC News. A major fire in Akron, Ohio. Five alarm fire. Seven counties have been called in. The source of the fire is the Joe Smith Lumber Company. Gone up in flames. Now, we will bring you details later. So, now, everybody in the restaurant tipped off except this guy and his wife.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're sitting there, and now he brings you back to your special, like they got back to your regular broadcast. 5 minutes later, comes back, turns up the volume, and he repeats the same message and goes into detail. Now, nobody got hurt, nobody got killed, but the whole place went up in flames, millions of dollars in damages. Now about that time, this guy, Joe and Mary Smith, and they're sitting there going, I think we just heard there was a fire in the radio. We got to go. They grab their coats. They're heading for the door. They're heading for Union Station. Out comes my grandfather. Hey, where are you going? Oh, man, it was nice meeting you, but I hear in the radio there's a major fire in Akron, Ohio. I think we're on fire. I got to go. Wait a minute. Come on back here. I pulled a joke on you. Let's all have a drink. Bah, the whole place bust out laughing. And the guy's like, what the hell's going on? And he goes, Joe, Mary, it was just a joke. It was just a joke. And all of a sudden, he starts laughing.
Yeah.
And the place, they had the greatest time that night. So, and then my grandfather says, now, you should have been here last night. I wiped out Seattle. It sounds crazy today, but it was a great prank of its time. And then with the land they owned down in Indiana near Crown Point, there was a fire chief convention every year. And there was a new fire chief from Crown Point, Indiana that came in that night. And, of course, my grandfather burned down Crown Point.
The
whole city of Crown Point is on fire. And the chief's whereabouts is unknown. This guy's flipping out.
Yeah.
My grandpa became very well known for it. So through the years, a lot of firemen hung their hats on the wall.
Wow.
So those were great pranks of their day.
My grandfather got up they lived above Halsted Street. Lived upstairs.
Uh-huh.
And he'll come down in the morning, and so first thing in the morning, always made sure, my grandmother made sure that she had a bowl of cornflakes sitting out there with a pitcher of milk or cream every morning.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets up one morning, he's got a little hangover, his hair is all messed up, he's got a robe on, he's in a lousy mood. Shuffles himself into the kitchen, sits down, groveling. He gets his cornflakes, he grabs the pitcher, pours the pitcher into the bowl, it's empty. Katie! It's my grandmother. That's my grandmother's name. Katie! Where's the milk?
Oh, man, I'm sorry. We're all out of milk.
Good. I wanted milk up here every single day. And now you're out of milk or cream. There's no cream? No cream. Son of a...
He gets up. He goes to the liquor cabinet. Perhaps a bottle of Old Charter 100 proof whiskey, bonded whiskey. He poured it over his cornflakes and he ate it.
And told her never to run out of milk again, huh?
She never ran out of milk again until the later years when he passed.
Yeah.
But, you know, to think that he would do something like that, because he loved whiskey, he loved beer.
Yeah.
But do something like that is just out of the ordinary, which is unheard of nowadays. When he poured it over his place, he was thoroughly content. And he groveled, and he ate it. You know, I have one more story about my grandfather. It was about World War II. Whiskey was rationed. So in order to buy whiskey, he had to buy rum. And for those years, it was my older brothers, Matt and Ed, were helping out my grandfather back in the 40s. My dad was too young.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing the buying. And so in comes this Italian guy, and he's got a big trench coat on with a fedora, and he says, you know, it's World War II. Whiskey's being rationed. You got to buy rum. And, of course, my grandfather groveled when he heard that. And so through the course of 4 years, He had a whole basement full of rum.
Because he couldn't sell it? Nobody was interested in buying rum?
You know, of course, his patrons weren't interested in it.
Yeah.
So he was stuck with it. So the war ends. By 1950, my dad's 20 years old. My dad's mopping floors for my grandfather. And he's pretty much going into semi-retirement now. And in comes the same salesman. The Korean War just broke out. In comes the salesman. He goes, where's your brothers, Matt and Ed? Oh, they're not here right now. I'm Charlie. I tell them that with the Korean War breaking out, whiskey's going to be rationed again. You have to buy some rum. My father got so mad. Charlie, he took the mop and he swung it at him. He says, you son of a bitch, get out of here. And all the commotion, down comes my Uncle Matt. What the hell are you doing? But the guy's trying to tell us that whiskey's being rationed and we have to buy rum. Oh, really? Picked up the phone. He called Hiram Walker distributors or the distillers, and he had the guy fired the next day.
So basically, he was just trying to push his rum that he had extra and he couldn't sell, mm-hmm. saying, that's all we've got, and you're going to have to take it. Huh?
You got it. Unbelievable.
Yeah, funny.
But my grandfather's, his biggest highlight of his, biggest part of his career was during the war years, during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And his oldest sons, Matt and Ed, they were 7 years older than my dad. They were in the Army, but they were down in Jackson, Mississippi. I think my grandfather pulled a couple of strings to be able to keep him stay here.
Uh-huh.
So every serviceman that came in that night, he would always take care of them first. And he entertained them all, and they all wrote him letters back. Now, my oldest cousin, Michelle Doherty, she has all these letters. And it's very interesting. But that's how he became... His biggest part of his career was during the World War II years. And in my early 50s, he semi-retired, and they had a home out in Fox Lake, Illinois. And then his sons were running the business. But that's pretty much what his life was. And then he passed on at 1967.
Mm-hmm.
He was 73 years old. And here's a guy who drank Schlitz beer all day long.
Yeah.
And his favorite food was... He instructed his chefs when a prime rib would come out of the oven, there was a top inch fat covering with mm-hmm. seasoned with salt, pepper, and garlic. They were instructed to put it on 2 slices of rye bread and bring it out to him immediately. And he ate that.
And then smoked Amazing. Cigars also. Yeah.
And he smoked cigars too. He drank whiskey. But you know, he was never introduced to junk food and preservatives. That's why he lived so long, for that big a man.
Wow.
So he was a man of his day. He was, in his time, he was huge. Everybody
wow.
knew him. And when they waked him, 67, there were 3 nights. They waked him 3 nights. There were that many people.
Hmm.
Absolutely amazing.
Friends and customers and family and everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yep, friends, customers, family, and he had so many friends at that time. But
wow.
very well known in his day. But by the early 50s, he semi-retired. My uncles took over. My dad was 7 years younger. He was still working for them, and they were running the business. And by 1953, my uncle Matt was killed in a plane crash. So my father Charlie became an instant partner with his older brother Eddie.
Okay.
So they ran the business. They ran the business through the 50s and 60s, and they did magic too. And by 1975, my dad Charlie bought out his brother Eddie. Probably the best moves that the two of them ever made. They became best of friends after that.
Mm-hmm.
We all know how family businesses are. They're very tough.
Yes.
Then I got involved in the business by 1975, and I did everything. I tended bar, dishwash, cooked, sweeped. You know, I did all the positions. And by 1979, I became general manager, and it was time to learn magic. So I was 25. So my childhood on magic is a little different than kids today. I was 25 years old, and I was becoming general manager. So my dad said, you know, you don't have to learn magic, but I guarantee you, first night they're going to ask you, do you do magic? And if you say no, they're going to give you a dumb look. So I started learning magic.
Because they knew that you were a Shulian, and with the last name of Shulian, that all Shulians
Absolutely.
Have to do magic.
So it was very hard at first because I had to learn how to shuffle cards like my father. And my father never had any patience. God love him. And I had to learn how to shuffle cards his way. And every night before I came on the floor, I had to take like 2 aspirin. Because every night I had to sit down and do some magic for somebody, and I'm fumbling cards everywhere. But nobody minded because I was young, you know, and I was a shoo-in. But eventually, as the months passed, you know, I got the color changed down pretty good in the matchbook trick. I finally learned how to fold the matches correctly. And it all started coming together, and after about a year, I was flying along. And then Al James came on board with us, and I learned a lot of some magic from Al James, too. He worked for us for late 70s to 1999, so it was over 20 years. So I learned some magic from him, too.
How many nights a week did Al James work?
He worked 5 nights a week.
Okay.
He worked 5. Yeah.
And all he did was magic. He didn't bartend or any of the rest of the
games? He did bartending in the beginning, but it didn't work out because there's too much bartending going on. And you know, then and you're trying to do magic. It's very hard to do.
Now, yeah.
I was able to do it because I was real young. I could fly up and down that bar. Today, I'm moving a little slower. But I can make things fast, yeah. No kidding, but it was a little different for me in my childhood. I didn't, you know, the only magic shop that I really went to was Magic Incorporated. I know Tim Felix out in Midwest Magic Shop. I didn't get to meet him until years later. So, and I really didn't dabble in magic because I guess it was just part of our family, and I was just working so much going to school. Mm-hmm. And but when I started doing magic, it became a job.
It wasn't something that you really enjoyed as a hobby.
Well, I didn't take it up as a hobby. It was a job, but I enjoyed it. It was a job.
Oh,
so at 12 midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, we'd lock up. We would go to the New York Lounge over on Lincoln Avenue. Oh, my God. Sit there till 4 in the morning, had a good time. And we watched them do magic, and we just laughed at them all because we all knew each other. Those were fun days in the New York Lounge, and that's how I got to meet Bill Weimer. And Al James came from there, too. My dad hired Al James. But the first magician that worked with me was a gentleman by the name of Chuck Morris. I don't know what happened to Chuck. I can't find him on the Internet. But if Chuck's listening to this, please give me a call. But during my grandfather's years, back in the late 40s, early 50s, Don Allen worked for my grandfather, a very well-known magician.
I assume he already had his Magic Ranch on television, or was this pre-?
Yeah, that was in the early 1950s. The funny thing was, he had his Magic Ranch, and it all was eventually put on DVD. Mm-hmm. So when I thought about this years later, I looked at the DVD. I didn't see my grandfather. I thought, oh, I would have film with my grandfather. My grandfather never liked television because there was a constant, there was always like, cut, the lighting's not good, we didn't see a certain move, can you turn a little bit this way? And my grandfather always felt that if you did it 3 times in a row, then the effect is gone with the audience. So he never liked TV. He was on TV once with my Uncle Eddie and my dad. I remember it was at CBS, I believe, back in the early 60s, and he did a half-hour magic. I know I wasn't thrilled about that, but he did it. But we do have 2 minutes of film. The old films out in the country doing
like
magic.
Super 8 millimeter or something like that?
Eight millimeter. 8 millimeter. Thank you. And he was doing magic with my grandmother, grandmother Katie, and watching his moves. He did the color change, and he was pulling cards out of Katie's ears. It was so smooth. And for a huge man with huge hands, he had baby hands, baby-looking hands.
And it was all pretty much self-taught. I mean, I assume that, as you said, Terry Blackstone's...
Yeah, pretty much.
Just from books or other magicians that he would learn from, or just things he made up and...
He probably learned from other magicians. You know, I don't know if he read any books or not. Maybe he did. But I think it's pretty much self-taught.
Yeah, going back just a minute, I wanted to let you finish your story over there, but going back, let's say, like to Al Capone, when you had mentioned that, I assume you said there was a story when Al Capone came in and put the $100 bill down. Did he ever come back a second time, or did he feel threatened or intimidated, and that maybe Al Capone was wanting a piece of his business or something, or that he was paying to get in?
The only story that my dad told me that he came in there once.
Okay.
Dad told me a story about they were all out in front of Halsa Street playing in the late 30s, or in the middle 30s. My dad's 5-6 years old, out in front kicking cans or whatever. And there was a barber shop 3 doors down.
Mm-hmm.
And saw a big sedan pull up, 3 guys with overcoats on, walked into this barber shop, and my father heard 3 gunshots, bang, bang, bang. They walked out, got a sedan, and drove away. My dad just stood there and stared. He couldn't believe it. But those are the old days, you know. That's about all we know about Prohibition of my grandfather. There's not much more.
And then going further, that you said that when Harry Blackstone Sr. came in, I knew he worked Chicago and was, very familiar and a celebrity back in those days. So when he came in, I'm sure your dad treated him with great respect, and so he was impressed by what he did. So.
Oh, but the story I forgot to tell you was he pulled that fire prank on Harry Blackstone Sr.
He
didn't know about this, and he burned down his theatrical warehouse.
With all of his props and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next day, the other night, he's like, oh, that was great, Matt, that was funny. The next day he walks to the door, he says, "Hey, Matt, remember last night?" He goes, "Yeah." He opens up his coat. Doves, pigeons, and rabbits were flying out of the coat. They were flying all around the tavern. He says, I told you I'd get you, Matt. And he did. My grandfather's like, get these darn things out of here. And he walked out the door. Pigeons are flying around, doves, rabbits are running across the bar. It had to be hysterical.
Wow, that was funny. Now, and then going on to other magic bars, you had mentioned the New York Lounge. I did want to get into Chicago-style magic and how that differs from other styles of magic, but also what was it that got that style started, and what came first? Was it Shulian's or the New York Lounge? And it seems like there were a couple of other magic bars around Chicago.
Shulian's first. My grandfather invented the bar magic, Shulian style, Chicago-style bar magic. Bar magic is fast and quick. It's not one of these tricks where you lay out 6 piles of cards, pick a pile, you know what I'm saying? Count down 10 cards. It's a quick, fast trick. Get the effect, move on to the next trick. That's pretty much what that is. He invented that. By the early 40s, the New York Lounge opened up on Irving Park and Clark Street.
And how far away from Shulian's was that?
It was probably about 2-3 miles north.
Okay.
Wasn't far. And they opened up there, and then they eventually moved over to Lincoln Avenue and Foster.
Did the New York Lounge structure its business model after Shulian's? In other words, I assume that they may have been to Shulian's and saw how the bar magic was working and said, hey, we're going to move somewhere down the street and open up our own place.
Yeah, pretty much. They did. From what I understand, it was just a bar at first. And there was a gentleman that was working there named Al Andrewski. Little guy named Al Andrewski. And his magic words were Heba Haba. Say the magic words Heba Haba. And
Heba Haba Al. Yep.
Heba Haba Al. He started doing magic in that bar, and all of a sudden they decided, well, we're going to start doing magic now. And that's how that all started. But by the 60s or whenever they moved to Lincoln Inn, that's when I started going there. There were like 4 magicians behind the bar with 2 bartenders. And they were all instructed to tend bar and do magic. So, if I can say this on the radio, there was a little sign underneath the bar, all around the bar, with the letters GTFM. It stood for Get the Effin' Money.
Yeah.
So when Uncle Jack would yell out GTFM, GTFM. They all stopped doing magic, and they were pouring drinks as fast as they could. But that was their only source of revenue. It was funny as you know what. It was just, it was a great place, and Bill Walmer got his start there, and he learned how to work 6-7 straight hours doing magic, and you don't stop.
And Bill Malone, I think, didn't he start there too?
Bill Malone started there too. He did too.
Yeah. I've heard that term of GTFM from Doc Eason, and yeah, I know the importance of what that is, and I think that that is something that anybody who's working a bar or a restaurant certainly needs to take to heart, knowing that you are just there as entertainment, but the bottom line is the profit, the money that the establishment is able to make so they can hire you and bring you back. And so you're just kind of an attraction, basically. So always remember to serve drinks, to make sure that you get out of the way of the waiters and wait staff, so this way they can serve the food and everything, because that is a very high priority. Now, a question about the New York Lounge. You said on Lincoln Avenue, was that not too far away from Magic Inc., Magic Shop?
It was like 2 blocks away from Magic Inc.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because many years ago, I had gone there with Jay Marshall. I was visiting mm-hmm. with him at Magic Inc., and after hours, he said, well, let's go on over to the New York Lounge. And I was thinking that we just walked down the block over there, and that was the first and only time that I had done that. And I'll never forget, it was a wonderful evening, and I don't remember who it was that sat down at the table, but I thought that was interesting that someone actually pulled a chair up, and they sat at the table and performed magic at our table. And I hadn't seen that style of magic before. Again, usually it's just kind of a walk around or strolling. They kind of stand by your table or behind the bar. But the fact that he was moving from table to table, and it's like he was just another guest at the table with you.
Sure. And that's what we did as shoelings. We pretty much, you know, behind the bar, we stood at the tables we sat. So when Jimmy Krizak came on with us, he was working at the New York Lounge, and my dad says, Jimmy, go ahead and sit down and relax and do magic. And Jimmy's like, can I really? I'm tired of standing. Oh, thanks, boss. And he took a lot of pressure off his back. Well, Jimmy's up in heaven playing cards right now. He's having a good time. God rest his soul.
Yeah. What other magic bars were there around? Because during the heyday, I thought there were 4, 5, 6 different bars in and around the Chicago area that specialized or had bars.
What I remember is, what I went to, well, it was the New York Lounge, us in the New York Lounge. There was a little bit of magic down on the south side. They did magic. I think I was down there once when I was very young. I don't remember too well. There was the barn down on the south side with Ernie Spence. I don't know if he's still alive, but he was very good.
Boy, I haven't seen him in many years. I remember that name. Yeah. Now, that little bit of magic, did Jeff Bibbick work at that place?
I think he did. I'm not sure. I know Bill Weimer worked there, and there was a little bit of Magic 2, then a little bit of Magic 3. And then there was the Ivanhoe on Clark Street, on Clark and Halsted. And that was Frank Everhart. He was a bartender, and he did Magic 2. So they were well-known for their – he was well-known in their day, too. But the only places that I knew that did magic, I didn't really get out and visit a lot of other places.
You mentioned Bill Weimer, and I know that he had written the – very important book about bar magic and about magic in Chicago.
Now you see it, now you don't.
Yeah, that's the title of the book. And,
it's a good book.
I highly recommend that.
It's a great book. Yeah.
Covered a lot of stuff, plus it taught some pretty cool tricks in there that are actual real commercial routines that you can do at the restaurants and bars.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And Bill's one of the best close-up guys I've ever seen. Bill's fast and he's quick, and he's always got another trick up his sleeve. You can always come up with something different.
All right. I would like for just a minute to kind of go a little bit in a different direction, not just talking about the magic bars, but kind of the magic scene as it was around Chicago. Because I remember one of my best friend, Don Weiberg, there in Chicago, was telling me about so many different Chicagoland magic shops that, I mean, there were like 6 or 8 of them within a 3-block area in downtown Chicago at one point. Do you remember any of those old shops, or did you used to frequent those? I mean, would you go down by a new trick?
No, I didn't. I knew there was Ireland's, but that was before Magic Incorporated, I believe. There was Ireland's was downtown. They were big in their day. And but I really didn't frequent them until I got older. I didn't go to them.
Okay.
It just wasn't a priority of mine at that time in life.
Well, I guess not, because actually you were more involved with the business side of it, and you're probably – now, that was another thing, that you would have the same patrons, I would think, to come in, so you would have to have some sort of different tricks. I'm sure that there are some things saying, this is a favorite. Hey, would you show Bob or Sally over here that trick you showed us last night? And that
you
are
know,
some favorites.
Usually at a table, if we weren't really pressed for time, I do about 6, 7, 8 tricks. But if we were pressed for time with people waiting for tables – I would do the pour, the color change, the matchbook, the card in the glass, and underneath the tablecloth. That'd be four tricks. Ask them how you're doing, where you're from, and people seem to be content with that. You know, people were happy with it. But if we weren't pressed for time, I could do four or five other tricks that I learned from Al James, or I can make up something as I go along, you know, and I've been doing it for so long.
Right, but there were some other types of, I'm just saying that I would think you would have to have a pretty good and a deep repertoire, so that way that you do have repeat customers say, hey, let me show you something special I've been working on, or something like that.
Yeah, I didn't learn a lot of tricks at that time. I just pretty much stuck with what I had. But once in a while, I came up with something new, you know, if I was getting a little bored. You know, because, you know, magic is a job, too, you know, and you can get
sure.
bored doing it. That's why you got to come up with something new all the time, you know, bring
of
up.
Of course. One of the tricks you just mentioned in that short repertoire, that set that you were mentioning, obviously, I guess the last trick you'd finish was the card under the tablecloth. For those who aren't familiar, that a card is selected and vanished from the deck, and then you pour water on the tablecloth, and you can see then the card, which is under the tablecloth, as it becomes visible.
It's a great ending for, it's a nice ending for my entertainment, because I can get them to say, good night, folks, and I walk away. I leave them stuck. I love it.
The so what do you do with the wet tablecloth?
We just roll them up and throw them back in the hamper, and they get washed, and you go back to the laundry. Laundry guys were very happy with us. But you know what's funny? For restaurants now, you don't see white tablecloths anymore, hardly.
Yeah,
and
true.
If you see a white tablecloth somewhere, boy, you are paying. You are paying through the nose, dollar, you know, menu-wise.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
So if I ever open up a restaurant someday, I got to make sure I got to have white tablecloths so I can do that card trick. But,
yeah.
But the biggest trick out of those was the card against the wall. My grandfather would select the card, he'd palm it off, and while they were cutting the cards, my grandfather would stick a thumbtack in the card, place
uh-huh.
it back in the deck, he would throw it against the wall, and the card
yeah.
would stick. Now, there's a certain area in Halsted Street, I've seen pictures where you could throw them where the wood was porous, where the thumbtack would stick. And then I'm down at 2100 on Irene Park, down at the end of the bar, where the wood was porous and it would stick. And it was a great effect. The cards would go flying, and there's your card. And people loved that trick. But when he passed in 1967, my father and my uncle Eddie, they decided to retire his trick. And they never did it. So now that I'm doing magic again, I've decided to, I'm kind of put it into my repertoire, but I'm using a little, dollhouse wax.
Wax. Yeah,
I put the wax in the back of it because it's, you know, you don't know what kind of wall you're going to throw it against. But it's a great effect. People love it. It's a great trick. Now, it's been done many different ways throughout the industry. They throw them against the ceiling, card would stick. So... But that was a great trick of his time.
Yeah, I think that by throwing it on the ceiling, first of all, people are not going to be able to peel it off the ceiling without getting a ladder or whatever to get up there, and they can see it,
sure.
and it stays there a lot longer, whereas if you throw it on the wall, whether it's with a thumbtack or with wax to adhere over there, they can walk up and see it, and if it's not high enough, I think that they could, you know, peel it off and say, oh, there was some wax. That's what's holding. I think that's part of the magic and the fun of that, of... I've had people who have asked, how does that stay up there? Because they can see there's not a thumbtack.
Right.
You know, I think Paul Harris had an effect also in one of his books that I used, where that you would have a thumbtack and a bill and then fold some, put a couple quarters in it and then fold it lengthwise a couple of times and then kind of like a helicopter blades. And when you throw it up, it sticks and the bill and the coins come down, but the coins have enough weight to push against a thumbtack to make it stick in the ceiling. It's a great trick. And also when it comes in, the people come in, they'll say, you know, what's that $20? Yeah. What's that $20 bill doing on the ceiling? And then you'll say, you got 20 and I'll show you, you know,
the ceiling of the bar room was loaded with bills. And my grandfather came into the front door one morning, and the door was jimmied open. He walked in, and there was a room laying on the floor. And someone got up on the bar, swept all the bills off the ceiling, took all the money. There had to be maybe $100, $200 up there.
Sure.
They were so high up, but somebody got up on the bar and took a broom, and they swept it all off and knocked them down.
You know,
oh, yeah.
a buddy of mine, Pat Hazel. This is the first time that I'd actually seen that trick, and Pat had shared that with me in Omaha. He was a house magician at a restaurant up there, and he said that he would leave the bills up on the ceiling, and then whenever he got ready to travel or he was going to, you know, need the money for whatever reason, during after hours, he'd get a ladder and pull all the money down, and it'd be, as you say, several hundred dollars. Well, I thought once he moved and I moved to Omaha and he went to LA to work with Seinfeld and do some other things, but I had come in and start working the restaurant, and I was doing that trick. And the next week I came in, the bills were gone. And I asked, I said, you know, they didn't tell me, but obviously a waiter or somebody, I thought, huh, well, I wonder how he got to keep them up there. But I couldn't because someone, as you say, were kind of sweeping the ceiling of my tips, you know.
Yeah,
that was a great trick. Also, another thing that you had mentioned then, Bob, that you are one of 22 grandchildren of Matt Shulian. And so how many of you actually do magic or remained in the business?
I'm the only one. I have a cousin, Matt Doherty. He dabbles in it.
Uh-huh.
But he just dabbles. He stands at a bar and does the four aces trick. He does a couple card tricks. He's a spitting image of my grandfather.
So he's a heavy set man also, I assume?
He's in his late 60s. He's not real heavy set, but
he
knew my grandfather. My cousin Tom, his brother, and his sister Michelle, they knew my grandfather the best because they were old enough. And I never really knew my grandfather. I remember him doing magic for us out in the country, kidding around with us, you know. That's about it. But they knew him well.
Phil Wilmarth, I believe, is one who wrote the book called The Magic of Matt Shulian. Was that that was your father or your grandfather?
That was my grandfather, Matt Shulian.
Okay, that was all about that. So how much magic did your father actually do?
Well, it was funny that day. He worked the lunch, he went home, took a little nap, and he came back around 5:30 with a little hangover. He found and he completely forgot that they were doing a photo shoot with Phil Wilmarth.
Uh-huh.
And Jay Mark. And my father had a hangover, so in those pictures he didn't smile. But he wasn't too happy. But there's Mark already, and he did magic too, and Matt did some magic too, and it was a nice book. We're looking to the book's been changed once or twice. I'm looking to kind of maybe changing the book up a little bit, bring it up to date.
Yeah.
So that's what we're starting to work on now.
Is that going to be published through Magic Inc.?
It'll be published through Magic Inc. They own the rights.
Yeah.
But I want to add some sections to it, and I want to talk about my dad. My dad, Charlie, I want to give my father his due. My father was just like his father, Matt. He was an entertainer. Knew how to entertain. Magic is 90% entertaining. You don't have to be the greatest magician in the world. But you know how to entertain and make people laugh. That's
right.
The most important thing. Because our magic was never the greatest. Because I had 12-year-old kids used to come in and they do better magic than me. I used to tell them, okay, kid, you're hired. That's all. Come back when you're 20. But we had a banquet room that seated 60 people. And I remember watching my father and my dad would sit down at the table. He would keep all 60 people involved. Because, you know, people can start talking on the side and laughing, talk about other things. My dad knew how to draw people in. Sir, come over here. He's got a card. That would pull everybody in. My father was good. He was an entertainer. My dad loved people. He loved the restaurant business. He loved doing magic. He was good at it. That's how I learned from him. But, you know, when I was a kid, we were little. When we would come down for dinner, my mom would bring us down for dinner. Me and my two sisters... My dad would be entertaining 6 people, and I'd come in, I'd walk over to a table, and I'd stand behind him.
Uh-huh.
And my dad taught me the trick is how he would tap the cards on the table, tap the deck on the table, just kind of get my attention. All right, Bob, think of a card. And, of course, the card, he's flashing to me, the bottom card. Bob, think of a card. Okay. And he did. My dad was a great forcer. All right, ma'am, tell Mary what her card is. Ace of Diamonds. How did you know that? That was great, and that was kind of like my introduction to it. But I remember watching him, and he was good. You know, he was very, very good. We have him on some film. We did a Schlitz Spirit commercial back in 1979.
Using magic?
And doing magic. Mm-hmm. It went from coast to coast.
Hmm.
And it was tied in with three other beer, Schlitz beer commercials. From New York to Chicago, they come to play a little magician's bar. And there was my dad and I. And so I get to see myself at 24 years old again.
Now, is that video on YouTube?
No, but I'm thinking about doing it.
Yeah, you got to upload that.
Yeah, it's a great video. It's my dad was good in that. He did the color change, and it was flawless.
Wow.
And then they made a Schlitz beer bottle, like appear underneath the napkin. It was great. It was just it's great.
Well, let me ask a little bit more about the Chicago Magic Lounge then. Again, I had done a podcast with John Stark and the other fellow who is a co-owner. I can't remember his name right now.
Joey Cranford and John Stark.
Yep, Joey Cranford was the other gentleman. And so I spoke with them as they were getting ready to open, I think like a week or two before the Chicago Magic Lounge opened.
Mm-hmm.
And that place seems to be going like a real house of fire. I mean, that it has really caused a resurgence of interest in magic in Chicago, because I've seen things on WGN television. There have been lots of news stories, things on the internet. And so they've been great, great marketers. But beyond that, when I have attended, it was like standing room only. This place gets packed. It's just gotten very successful.
They've done very well. It took a little time to get it, to get it going. But Joey Cranford, he's in marketing, so he knows what he's doing. And they they've done very well. It's amazing that it's all the young people, it's all the millennials that they've never seen this before. You know, absolutely amazing.
You know, that's a very good point. I felt as if that I was one of the oldest guys in there, and I'm sure that I was when I was there. But when you say millennials, that's true. And I felt kind of like it was a comedy club from the standpoint that some of the humor was comedy club-esque with some foul language, and the people were just rolling. And that's the kind of thing that I'm sure goes over very well. Obviously, it did with the younger millennials. It's not really the old-style magic, but there were some combinations of some classics that were thrown in there. John Stark performed that night, in fact, when I was there, and I was so impressed. I've seen him do cups and balls and other kinds of things, but I thought his show and the others were really entertaining, too. Plus, then you go back in that other room where they have close-up, and the fellow who I saw working that night was great, and I know that changes from week to week. So it is a wonderful venue, and what I think is interesting, too, like you were talking about at Shulian's and New York Lounge, where you had several magicians, I guess particularly in New York Lounge, I think you said they had three different magicians kind of strolling around. The same thing here, that it's a fairly small area from the standpoint, it looked like it only seats about, 160 people tops, maybe if that?
Roughly, about 150, 160.
Yeah, so how many, they got four of you guys? I mean, they're just bang, 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 running around all the tables.
Well, the first hour when people are coming in, there's about four, maybe five magicians strolling around doing close-up.
Uh-huh.
And then when the show starts, there's usually, then they have two of them on stage. Then
right.
They have a bar magician on Thursday nights in between acts. He performs behind the bar.
Because you have two nights. It's both Thursday and Saturday, is that correct?
Thursday and Saturday. And Saturday is a little more, we're a little close on time on Saturday, so we can't do any bar magic, but it starts at 7:30 on Thursday nights, 7:30 to 8:30 close-up, and then about 25 minutes for the first act, and then they do a little bar magic, about 20 minutes, and then the main stage comes on, does about 40, 45 minutes. And it's worked out pretty well. So,
yeah.
And then on Saturday nights, since they're fighting for time, it starts at 7. Then the first show starts at 8, and then it all ends around 9:30 because they have to clear out the room because they have another entertainment going on called Kiss Kiss Cabaret. It's a burlesque show,
mm-hmm.
And they've done very well with that. And then, but meanwhile, at 9:30, we move people in back, and then they do a private magic show in back.
Yeah, when I had gone back to watch that smaller close-up show in the other room, I heard something banging around and some music or something going on outside. And I was asking somebody, are the walls that thin or what's going on? Or, you know, is there, you know, and they said, well, no, there's another show going on the stage that is completely different.
Yeah.
Burlesque show. I said, what?
Right.
So it's kind of like they quickly do a switch and they go from magic to burlesque. So it's that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But it sounds like
it it's not a bad show. Oh, I think the show's pretty good. It's,
yeah.
I give a lot of the girls credit for being up there.
Sure.
Dancing.
Well, now, listen, I appreciate your time, and I'm glad that I was able to catch you, even though that it was on your cell phone, and I hope that the quality of this is good enough that everybody sticks around and listens all the way to the very end of our conversation over here, because you had a lot of really great stories, Bob, and I thank you for sharing those with us. And so the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, so my question to you is, what is it that is important? What would be your magic word or phrase, something that, and I don't mean like Heba Habba Al or, you know, or Alakazam or something like that, but what would be your philosophy of life, something you live by?
Well, I like to make people happy.
Make people happy. Ooh, I love that.
I want to entertain. I want to make people laugh.
Yeah.
That's the most important.
Yeah.
If I made you laugh for 20 minutes, great. People feel better because people need to laugh. But nobody's laughing nowadays. Everything is so tense.
The world's
going up in flames, and yeah, everybody's so serious.
Yeah,
and that's my father's philosophy was: let's entertain them for a few minutes. Let them relax.
Fantastic.
My father was absolutely right.
Good. Well, Bob, thank you very much. I appreciate you being a guest here on the Magic Word Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You're welcome. And so, for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Bob Shulian in Chicago, Illinois, and this is Scotty out. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate you being on the podcast and for sharing all those stories about your family. This was really an interesting lesson in magic history, particularly for the Chicago magic bar scene, and I had not heard many of those stories before. Some I have, but most I haven't, so it was great to hear them, particularly from the horse's mouth, someone who is a direct descendant right there in that fine family line of the Shulians. So again, Bob, thank you very much, and I'm sure the listeners thank you very much also. And now for something completely different. Some of the best advertising is word of mouth. That is that you get suggestions from friends and then you end up using something that your friends like or they recommend, like with movies, for an example. Whenever you go to see a movie, a lot of times it's because someone had recommended that or you heard it was good and you like what they like. Well, I know that many of you listeners have followed me for a long time, and I do make some recommendations, like my product reviews from time to time, too. And so I thought it would be interesting that you might like to know a little handy instrument that I recently acquired. It's called a cell grasp. That's a cell like cell phone, grasp, G-R-A-S-P, because that you can hang on to this thing so easily, and your phone is not going to fall out of your hands, particularly when you're taking a selfie. You can take it, you can keep it steady when you're holding it, and it's not going to drop or anything. And I came across this actually through my Instagram account. And so, by the way, if you're not following me, you can do that at Scott Wells Magic. And the fella that was offering these, it goes through Cell Grasp Life, that's L-I-F-E, but he also goes by Fantasy, that's S-E-A, Sailing, Fantasy Sailing. And it's Captain Paul West, and he's a friend of mine, and I've got him on the phone right now. So, hi there, Paul.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm fantastic, thank you. And you're down in Florida, I understand, and you actually are a captain, and you created these things so they won't fall off the boat while you're taking people out to sea.
Actually, that was the main idea behind the whole thing, because I watched people for the last couple of decades dropping their phones on the deck and breaking their glass and getting mad, and I was giving them tissues to wipe up their tears, and you know, I've watched some shooting dolphins and dropping them into the water. And basically the whole idea was to find just something to hold the cell phone to their hands. I was looking for wrist straps or something like that. You know, I'm an entrepreneur and magician and all that kind of stuff, you know, but I just wanted to get something to keep them from doing that. And wrist straps weren't an option.
Right.
So I woke up with a crazy idea one morning. I wrote it down and went through about 25 versions in 3 years in the patent process and went, well, this is cool. I think it's time to put it on the market.
Yeah. Now you started off. You said like anything else. I mean, I have written books and worked on lecture notes, and of course, as many of us, including yourself, have worked on tricks. And you try and find the right lines. You're always fine tuning and everything. And the creative process with something that you're inventing as an entrepreneur is just as difficult, if not more so, than creating a magic trick, isn't it?
It was probably, according to my wife, the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. It's consumed about 16 hours a day for 3 years, and then also being a sailor and a professional magician, I felt like I'm scheduling times to walk the dog and say hi to mama and all that stuff. So
wow.
It's crazy.
Your time is busy and very valuable. And so this little thing, originally I think you had told me that you had a bigger contraption and it was going to cost like $50 or something, and you decided, hey, this is not going to work. It's got to be more realistic price-wise. You got to bring it way down in price.
Yep, the dream I had was so I could have something that was going to fit most cell phones, so that people didn't have to change their cases, and they didn't have to buy anything special and slips on, slips off, no glues or Velcro or sticky stuff, you know. So it was this contraption that kind of went around the outside of it. I took it to a manufacturer buddy of mine, and he said, simplify it. So he says, otherwise it's going to cost a lot of money. So we got it to the simplest form possible. It does exactly what it's supposed to do, and it fits mm-hmm. in your pocket. It's flexible and just works, you know. So.
Right. What I like about this, I guess, is how flexible, just as you say it is. It can slip right on and off your phone, and that it can fit any size phone, whether you have a larger mobile phone or whether you have the smaller phone. I mean, whether it's an iPhone or an Android, doesn't matter.
Exactly. Yeah, that was the plan.
And also that on the front of it, that it has a see-through piece of plastic or something that you can still scroll your thumb back and forth, and you can operate the phone switch. And if you need to take the thing off, you can do that easily enough. And it, again, adjusts for sizes, although you just have two sizes. You have small and large or something like that?
Yeah, two sizes fit most phones with their cases or without their cases. It's basically a continuous loop. The backside has the elastic with the finger loops that you can stick your fingers in. Front side's kind of a flexible vinyl-type lens, but it's touch-sensitive, so you can't work all your screen functions.
And so for people who want to find out more about this, and they can actually see pictures and videos and order one, what's the website?
Website is CellGrasp. That's one word, CellGrasp.com. And that's where the website is. It's available on Amazon, things like that, too. But at the same time, it's CellGrasp is where you get the information. We also have links to our YouTube videos, which are a good training spot, and it teaches you how to work it and different, because there's so many different grips. It started off just to hold the phone. Then we found out it was great for selfies and videos, and it smoothed everything out. You instantly get better pictures because mm-hmm. you're concentrating on the content, not really the grip, because that silly grip where everybody holds their phones with their index fingers and their thumbs and has to have another finger to push the button. If one of those little contact points let loose, you drop your phone. And that's the problem that we solved.
Right. A lot of thinking went behind this. Well, again, I would encourage the listeners to go out and just check it out. I think it's worth at least taking a look and see. And if you have a phone, and I know you do, that you're going to need to have one of these things to add to it. So, Paul, I think this is just a fantastic product, and I know that a lot of the listeners will be interested in ordering this. Is there any kind of a special deal perhaps you can offer to the listeners of the Magic Word Podcast?
Yeah, actually there is. In fact, most magicians out there will know me as Brother Paul. And in fact, I put out the stupid bean trick a while ago, so that kind of is following me around quite a bit. But if you go to brotherpaulmagic.com, that's brotherpaulmagic.com, I've got on the store, there's 5 instant downloads. And if you choose one of those, and when you check out with PayPal after you buy the CellGrasp, just write down which one you would like, and I will send that to you personally. No charge at all.
Wow, that's a great deal. So if they buy 2, 3, or 4 CellGrasps, they're going to get 2, 3, or 4, or 5, however many of the downloads.
That's exactly right. Let's do it that way.
That's a great deal. Well, thank you very much, and I wish you good luck. And everybody, go take a look. What have you got to lose? Everything to gain, and you'll thank me for this. All right, well, speaking of some product reviews, I think it's about time. Let's just do a couple of quick reviews from those things that are offered by Murphy's Magic Supplies. First up, from Sans Minds, is Flaming Coffee. I saw the video on this, and it was very impressive. Basically, what you have is, let's say, a Starbucks coffee cup in which you have like a plastic lid on top, and you remove the lid, and in just a moment, as you pull it away, you say, this coffee is pretty hot, and actually flames are shooting up out of it. And you can let that burn for a little while, and then you put the lid back on in order to douse the flame when you remove the lid and show that there is nothing there but just steaming hot coffee. The flames have subsided. And of course, you can just do a quick flash of the inside of the coffee lid to show that there's nothing there either. It just looks like the inside of a lid. This is a clever idea. Again, like with a lot of things from Sans Minds, that it is kind of angly. In fact, it's very angly that you don't want to let people see from the side. This is, again, one of those things that's best from the straight-on position. But the handling tips that they give you in the video are very clear. And I usually, when you're having coffee, it's just with a few friends, and they're not going to necessarily be seated behind you or to the extreme sides where they can kind of see what you're doing in order to do this. Now, coming along with the DVD are a couple of things that you need in order to accomplish this. You don't get the glue or the double-sided tape or whatever that you're going to be needing. Some things that you're going to have to just pull out of your drawer to make the thing yourself, because it is another one of these DIY things. A couple of tips I've noticed kind of in making this thing. One of the concerns I had was that whenever that you're soaking this with lighter fluid, that there is a little hole that is in the top of the lid for the coffee. And I always had a little bit of a concern that perhaps some of the poisonous lighter fluid might seep through, or if you soak it too much, it might drip through that little bit of a hole that would go into your coffee. And I don't know that you want to drink that. Of course, it'd be so diluted, it shouldn't be a issue. And I don't think that's a big problem. It's just something to consider. But beyond that, also, this is a gimmick which you probably have to make two or three of these things, depending upon how often that you plan to use it, because it will start to get a little bit singed, the lid itself, from use. And in fact, if you let the thing burn for too long, it could start to melt your lid, I guess, if you don't put it on quick enough. So it's just kind of some tricky handling you kind of have to play with. It is a pretty cool thing. I would certainly say that this is a great thing to show for television. If you happen to have a opportunity to perform on TV, or you're going to be on camera, or you want to do something on video that you want to post on YouTube or do for your friends that they can shoot with their camera or something that is going to be straight on, it is a pretty cool thing. In fact, after you do this, they're going to say, hey, let me record you doing that. And you really, it's going to take a while to go and reset this. Let me say, it's not something that is repeatable nor resettable. You have to say, excuse me just a minute, and take a while to get it reset. So unless you're carrying another lid on you, you're not going to be able then to repeat this. Again, it is a pretty good trick. I recommend it with some reservations. And by Sans Minds, that's called Flaming Coffee. Next up is something that I probably should have reviewed prior to Halloween, or at least put this on the Halloween podcast, because it's something that would have been just perfect for Halloween, but it is still something that kind of creeps out people if you show it any other time of the year as well. But it is especially good if you're going to be doing a seance, or if you're doing something that's going to have more of a creep factor, if you will, something that's kind of eerie. This is by Alakazam Magic out of the UK. It's called The Deceased, and it's by Jamie Dawes. I think it's a pretty darn cool idea, and basically you show these photographs of, they look like antique photographs, basically something from probably the 1800s, early 1900s or something like that. And you have 10 photographs. They're fairly wallet small, they're wallet size, and you, as you're going through them, you hand half of them to your volunteer, and they will put them behind their back as you do, and you're mixing them around, bring them around. Long story short, whenever that they reveal the cards and you have yours, one of the cards is going to be upside down in your stack and in their stack. And whenever that you reveal the upside down card, that you show that it matches what was in an envelope as a prediction beforehand, that are the same people, and those are the killers. And then the other eight people, when you turn over the cards, it says they're deceased or dead. A couple of really great things about this. One is that it lends a lot of opportunity for presentation. In fact, that's mainly what it is. There are no real tricky moves, nothing complicated, no finger flicking or anything. I mean, you talk about a beginner trick, it is from the standpoint of your handling of this. However, that like with most magic, you have to have a good presentation, and no more so important than it is in mentalism, and in particular with bizarre magic, where you're trying to tell a story that's going to be fairly believable. And so you need to spend some time in scripting this one to make sure that you can really get it across and get people to believe it. It's a really cool little idea, and it gives you some ideas on what you can do as far as trying to bring up some good ideas or some good scripting. And the cards themselves are well made. The only downside or the con side of this is I never like to do a trick, a card trick or anything, where the props are out of play or out of sight, I should say. In particular, these cards are placed behind the spectator's back, and then some are put behind your back. And whenever something goes out of view, you have no control. You can't see what's happening, and there's always that possibility for the volunteer to intentionally or unintentionally to mess up a little bit. And they're going to feel bad if they don't follow directions properly, or that if they're trying to screw you up a little bit, then they can certainly do it very easily by having the cards out of sight, and then it won't work properly. So again, I have that little bit of a proviso on the end of there that is on the downside of that I don't like about this. There are probably some other presentations, or I should say handling, that you can do that's not discussed on this DVD, but if you give it some thought, I believe that it lends itself to some other applications where they could be kept in full view for the whole time. It's like just where you put one on top and you duck the other and you discard or something. I believe there are some different ways that you can handle this in which that you would have the right outcome. Again, the basic premise of this is a living and dead test in which you will identify or predict two killers and the rest of the people then are dead who are in the photographs. A very cool little trick, and this is the first of the Dark series of Jamie Dawes, and I guess he's got some more stuff coming out, and I'm anxious to see what else he's going to present, because I like this kind of stuff. And if you like kind of the dark side and bizarre type of seance types of stuff, I believe this could be for you as well. It's called Deceased by Jamie Dawes. Well, there you go. A couple of good ones from Murphy's Magic Supplies, which you can purchase through your favorite magic dealer, which hopefully will be themagicwordpodcast.com. Just go over to the website and click on the magic store and help support us with your purchase. All right, well, that's pretty much a wrap for this week, but there are a few more things that I want to add here at the end. The first being that I have had some people who have contacted me about Skype lessons. Yes, I do give lessons via Skype. It doesn't matter where you live in the world or what your interest might be, from mentalism to marketing, close up to stage, whether you need some help on a trick you're working on, whether it's going to be scripting or coaching, stage direction, whatever, just give me a call or drop me an email, scott@themagicwordpodcast.com, and tell me what your needs are, and perhaps we might be able to get together and I can provide you with a little coaching and a lesson that will hopefully make you a better magician. Also, I do want to thank all of those who have been following me, and of course, if you're not already, you can on Instagram at Scott Wells Magic, or my Twitter account, which is Magic Word Pod. And on Facebook, of course, we are the Magic Word Podcast. So be sure and follow us and keep up to date on what's going on, and subscribe to the feed. So this way that you will never miss another podcast. We got a lot of interesting stuff coming up. I have already scheduled now through the end of the year. And in particular, the Christmas episode is something that, oh boy, it has taken tons of time. I mean, probably 24 to 30 hours already of putting the whole thing together, but for only about 20 minutes or so. But it's been fantastic. And I know that you're going to enjoy that as well. But between now and then, we have some other surprises for you as well. And I also want to thank those who are friends of the Magic Word who have been supporting us with your financial pledges, whether it's been ongoing through sponsorship by going to patreon.com and going through the Magic Word podcast and then supporting us with your monthly donations, or whether it's just been a one-time donation, all of those are accepted. Just think about perhaps whenever you're listening to this and you're having a cup of coffee that you're just sitting with me and you are buying a cup of coffee for me also. A buck or two or $5 or whatever the cost of a cup of coffee might be, just think about buying a cup of coffee for me once a month. That's all it would take. And if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, you can learn how that you can become a sustaining member or giving donations on a one-time basis to the Magic Word Podcast. One of the things that we have recently done is upgraded the URL, so this way that we are encrypted. We have an SSL certificate, so you might see a little green padlock or something up in the URL area of the website. That means that we are verified and encrypted, and so you know that we are secure, and whenever that you're going to be ordering something, everything is secure and everything is fine. And so again, speaking of ordering things, please go to the Magic Store here on the Magic Word Podcast and take a look at the different things we have available through Murphy's Magic Supplies. Well, again, I think that's probably a pretty full podcast here this month. Hope that you've enjoyed it. And so until next time, stay well, get booked, and make someone happy. This is Scotty out.